Thanks for clicking on this new edition of the Peter B. Collins Show via podcast. I'm really glad you're listening. And listeners support the launch of our podcast series. I really appreciate all the help we've been getting. And today I want to single out Nancy Patterson, a longtime supporter of the Peter B. Collins Show from Winters, California. You can help, too. Just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. You can subscribe voluntarily for as little as $5 a month, and every subscription helps. You're about to hear the latest installment in the Boiling Frog series of podcast interviews co-hosted with Sibel Edmonds. And if you haven't seen Sibel's new website, please stop by boilingfrogspost.com. She has recruited some great journalists who are just starting to publish important information there, and I hope you will check it out. You're about to hear two experts on Afghanistan, the husband and wife journalist team of Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. Earlier in 2009, they published Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. But before we get to Gould and Fitzgerald, I want to share with you the latest information from the Harris Poll of 2,300 American adults. In April of this year, there was a positive response to President Obama's handling of Afghanistan. 51% supported, 36% did not. By September, it was 54% to 36. And now it has flipped. 60% rate his handling of Afghanistan negatively. Only 31% are supportive. And when you break it down further, only 6% of adults now think the situation in Afghanistan is getting better. That's the lowest number recorded in any Harris poll asking this question. And those who believe the situation is getting worse, that's increased to 47%, and it was only at 28% in April. And now only 12% are confident that U.S. policies in Afghanistan will be successful. That's also the lowest number that they've ever recorded. 61% are not confident, and that's a jump from just 40% not confident in April. So the poll numbers are eroding. Are they listening in Washington? I'm not sure, but I'm glad you're listening here. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. And our guests in this broadcast are Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. They are married journalists who have, for almost 30 years now, been reporting on Afghanistan. And they started back in 1979, co-producing a documentary for Paul's television show called Watchworks. They returned in 1981, the first American TV crew to get visas to go into Afghanistan at that time. And their reports played on the CBS Evening News. They also produced a documentary in that era for PBS, and in 1983, they returned to Kabul for ABC Nightline. Their most recent book is Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published by City Lights Books here in San Francisco, and they are joining us on our program. Thank you both for joining us, Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould.
Well, thank you both for having us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me start by asking if you are, I was going to use the word pleased, but it probably doesn't fit here, but are you gratified that there is at least a debate underway in the United States now about our policy toward Afghanistan and the critical issues about a possible increase in American troop presence there.
Well, there's certainly a great deal of irony in our having come full circle after 30 years. We thought this kind of debate would be going on in 1979, 1980, and 81 during the Soviet occupation and the aftermath. Unfortunately, we tried to generate some of that dialogue back in that time period, and unfortunately, we couldn't really get the fire going. We did some things back in that time period that were very provocative. We actually got the first permission to go into Afghanistan when the entire Western media had been kicked out after the Soviet invasion. And I mean the entire Western media. There were no Western news stories coming out of Afghanistan. So we got the permission to go back in, and that's what we did for CBS News. And what, of course, we saw was a very, very different story from what the Cold War agenda was putting out during that time period. We saw a country that was very complex, where the population of the country had been trying to move towards modernization and under some very, very difficult post-colonial conditions. Both the Russians and the Imperial Russians and the British had imposed some very severe restraints on what was going on in terms of what Afghanistan could do externally and what they could do internally. And they had forced Afghanistan into a kind of forced neutrality for a long, long period of time. And so that's what they were trying to overcome. So it was a very, very difficult period for the Afghan people. And that was something that the American media wasn't particularly interested in talking about.
And I don't think there's actually that much interest today, except because of the extreme circumstances that the U.S. military is facing, really.
Well, indeed, and to be cold and cruel about it, the U.S. perspective is that Afghanistan is not important to our strategic interests except for its borders with Pakistan and Iran, and that in general we don't have any play there because there aren't massive natural resources that we could extract, and politically it's a country that has been ruled by warlords for a long time, and even today has a very limited central government. So it's in some ways understandable that the U.S. has turned a blind eye toward Afghanistan simply because we tend to focus on our self-interest more than the plight of people around the world and situations that don't affect our economic situation.
Well, we actually have three situations here that actually don't meet the reality that we actually, in our investigation to find out what really Afghanistan was about. I mean, number one, warlords actually didn't exist in Afghanistan preceding the Soviet occupation. The actual existence of warlords is a direct result of the extremists that were invited. And these are Arab Islamists, actually, that were invited that really were the what became known as the Al-Qaeda base. So, this was not an Afghan phenomena at all. There was no such thing as suicide bombers. The idea that there wasn't a central government in Afghanistan also was really revealed as really a very shallow explanation of the very complex relationship that the Durrani Empire had with the populations. That it was a Pashtun Durrani dynasty from the 1700s that ruled Afghanistan. But what was going on was a kind of really a much more sophisticated kind of rule. It was not colonial. It was not overbearing. It was very sophisticated in the sense that it could handle the very obviously very complex, nature of a lot of different ethnic groups and somehow move forward. And when you get into the 19th century and the early 20th century, you see amazing signs of direct attempt at modernization that was profound when you look at the fact that King Amanullah actually put forth ideas like a women getting the right to vote in the early 1920s, removing bride taxes and all kinds of tribal laws that really restricted the natural evolution of a lot of people in the population. So you can see that, really what they came up against was the British colonial attitude that was overtly against any kind of Islamic state being a symbol of how a modern Islamic state could be very progressive. And it was the British that undermined Amanullah's efforts in the 1920s that ended up with his having to abdicate his throne. So when you really look at the history, you realize that these really are very much a part of the crisis the Afghan people face today, when you consider the fact that Afghanistan really was the place chosen by Zbigniew Brzezinski to play out his desire to destroy the Soviet Union, and he effectively chose Afghanistan to be the place. Now, he wasn't alone in that, but he was the point man. He was the one inside the Carter administration that had the power. He had taken the power of the director of operations of the CIA from Cyrus Vance in the State Department. He moved it into the National Security Agency, and he began secret operations to destabilize the region with a relationship with China. And all of this was going on at a time when, you know, there were internal developments in Afghanistan that were still showing incredibly progressive, modern ideas.
I want to go back to your point on the mainstream media and the coverage. And in fact, for the past three decades of Afghanistan, which is one of the main reasons for the wrong picture, the false information, and the view of Afghanistan here in the United States. And I don't think a lot of it can be attributed to just simply ignorance or naivety. Can you tell us a little bit about why do you think it is and how it is managed, this this image that is being basically given to the American public by the MSM, and how that message is being controlled and how it has been formed?
Well, I mean, you know, I'll go back a little bit. I'll digress a little bit. The United States, I mean, today it's talked about how Obama is involved in a quagmire in Afghanistan, that he's repeating Vietnam. Well, what the United States does everywhere it goes is Vietnam. In South America, in other parts of the world, World War II, Korea, other places, what the United States does functioned correctly for the United States. It didn't work so well for the people of those places, but it worked well for the United States in terms of the interests that were involved, in terms of helping set up a corporatized government that was friendly to Washington. That was the purpose of it. It didn't work in Vietnam because it was too complicated. It's not going to work in Afghanistan. It hasn't worked in Afghanistan because Afghanistan is even probably far more complicated than Vietnam was. There are multi-ethnic issues. There are all kinds of political issues involved. There are issues in terms of the ancient nature of this place in the world. And so as a result of that, I just simply think that Afghanistan, one of the reasons why the media portrays Afghanistan as it does is because it's simply too complicated. We did an interview in 2002. We were in Kabul in 2002, and we interviewed a number of the American media. We did it intentionally to see what their focus on what was going on there was, having been there back in the early 1980s when the Russians were there. And we interviewed the USA Today correspondent, and he said, my editor back in New York wants it simple and clear. And the problem is that the story isn't simple and clear.
But there's also definitely, you can come up against many different agendas. I mean, we really could see, for instance, at CBS News that, you know, there was definitely a desire to hurt the Russians. That was a major provocative agenda. That they felt that, you know, the Vietnam War was really, effectively a win for the Soviet Union. And therefore, anything that they could do that was going to hurt the Soviets was going to somehow save the crisis that Vietnam produced for these people. So you get a lot of mixed up agendas. It's very hard sometimes to really get down to a clean, where did this line up? And I think that's where Zbigniew Brzezinski is so intriguing, because Brzezinski really wanted to destroy the Soviet Union. He was a tremendous motivator in many, many administrations to really just absolutely always, demand confrontation with the Soviets. There was no room for negotiation. There was no room for any kind of cooperative relationship. And so when you get an individual like that who is super motivated, you know, and he gets a lot of other systems going, and then he finds people within these other institutions that have the same kind, and I'm using the word intentionally. It's almost like an insanity. It's an obsession, and they simply have to hurt it. They have to destroy it.
Well, I'm glad you both have mentioned Brzezinski, because I think that he gets off very lightly, given the responsibility he had for our original participation using proxies against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And when he appears on television today, they never refer to that. They don't even, you know, acknowledge that he has experience and perspectives based on the work that he did in the Carter administration. But that's really where a lot of this started, and I want to come back to that a little bit later. But let me ask you both to first comment on the current situation and the options presented by General McChrystal of 10,000, 40,000, or 60,000 troops. And I spoke to a counterinsurgency expert recently who said that based on our military's own game plan for combating counterinsurgency, that we would need about 600,000 plus troops committed for over 5 years to really produce some sort of a result that we would be satisfied with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that no matter what numbers are currently being discussed, given the constraints and the limits on the forces that we have because of other deployments, that there really is no sensible route of increasing U.S. forces there because, in simple terms, I don't think it will make much difference. Paul, you want to start?
Well, I think that what General McChrystal is aiming at is trying to stabilize a deteriorating situation, and that's what the extra troops are for. From what we understand from the Afghans that we speak with, the situation is far worse than it's being reported in the press. The military situation is getting out of hand. They do not have enough. They do not have enough troops just to do the basic security that they need to protect their own forces. So this is what he's looking for. So it really has come down to either get them out of there because they're going to be overwhelmed, or bring in enough forces to be able to hold these areas that they are now in, or withdraw to the cities, which is kind of a desperate attempt at this point. I mean, can you imagine, you know, having the American and NATO forces just withdraw to some of the major areas as the Taliban swarms over the countryside and the U.S. and the West loses completely the support of the local population? That's nightmarish for all kinds of reasons, not just for Afghanistan, but also for Pakistan as well. So, I mean, there are very complex issues. I mean, I like to say that, you know, this is being compared to Vietnam. In the one sense, you know, the ramifications of what happened after Vietnam are minor compared to what would happen if the United States was forced to leave Afghanistan.
I think also we really have to consider that, you know, McChrystal really seems to be trying to make a major sea change effectively. He is trying to shift the entire idea of the way in which the Bush administration approached the situation, which everyone agrees was a complete failure. And certainly in terms, I guess, you know, we have to be careful when we use the term failure. In terms of Afghanistan's national interest, it was a complete failure. There may be other ways in which that may not have been a failure, and that's another discussion. But it seems as if McChrystal seems to be connecting to the idea that he wants to really try to support some kind of national ideal for Afghanistan. It's very tragic that, you know, he is coming now. Maybe it might have made a difference if he had been there in 2001. But now he's trying to pull it off, you know, when you now have a very sophisticated resurgence of the Taliban, when it was simply allowed to manifest in Pakistan for, you know, the last 7 years, really, full seven years at this point, and really, you know, develop all kinds of sophistication in its ability to, you know, to intervene in Afghanistan any way it wants. So this is really, you know, I think the challenge. And so what he's asking for at this point, I think, is really time. I'm not so convinced that it's the troop number per se. He's trying to say, give me more time.
everybody knows that, you know, you were right about the counterinsurgency doctrine. 500,000, 600,000, I think Dennis Blair actually said something somewhere in the estimate of 800,000, over 800,000 troops in order to do it correctly. No, those troops are not available. That's not going to happen. So I think Liz is right when she says that, you know, McChrystal is basically trying to buy time. He needs 12 months to 18 months in order to establish some kind of security in at least a section of the country where he can show that his ideas are working.
And those ideas definitely seem to be, at least this is what the man is saying. We obviously need the proof that he's going to follow through, and I guess that's the whole point about whether he's going to get the time to prove it. But he keeps claiming that he really wants to prove that he is there for the Afghan people. And our position has been, since the 1980s, that, you know, America has never represented the Afghan people, that has been the problem all along.
Well, that's what our research showed, was that you can go back to, you know, the 1940s, and you can see that Washington never really got Afghanistan. They never really understood. They never really appreciated it. And when Afghanistan was handed off from the British Empire in 1947, the United States just simply assumed the responsibilities of the British Empire, and they assumed the attitudes of the British Empire. And as far as the British Empire was concerned, of course, is that, you know, Afghanistan was just vacant, was a vacant lot that they wanted to use to put their pipelines through and to put their trade routes up into South Central Asia.
They also wanted to hurt Afghanistan because it obviously offended their ego that they had lost severely in Afghanistan.
Yeah. That's the psychological ramification of it, too. Their egos were their empirical ego was definitely damaged by the defeats that they suffered at the hands of the Afghans.
Now I want to talk about your recent piece for Counterpunch and a very important point there that we don't get to hear or read about, and that is China and Xinjiang, a.k.a. East Turkestan, a.k.a. Uyghuristan. Tell us a little bit about the whole region and the relation to Afghanistan, and then I have a follow-up question on that after you give us a little bit of background there.
The Chinese have had an active policy of colonizing Xinjiang province for many, many years, at least back to the 1960s, if not before that, for the purposes of establishing hegemony in that particular area. And this is one of the things that is very little known about Chinese involvement. The Sino-Soviet War, which preceded, of course, by a decade, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, had a lot to do. The tensions between the Soviet Union and China had a lot to do with the Soviets' concern about what was going on their southern border. Now, during that time period, of course, preceding, and this would have been the 1970s, from 1973 until 1978, in the Marxist coup in Afghanistan, the Chinese were cooperating in counterinsurgency efforts in that area, which were being used. They were training insurgents from Afghanistan who had left. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was being trained in Xinjiang province. The Chinese, of course, did not want anyone to know about that during that time period. But their involvement in that area of the world, they were very supportive of the Pakistanis, very supportive of the development of their nuclear program. They have played a silent role in their involvement in this arena for many, many years. And now, of course, the piece that we wrote for Counterpunch was something that they are now appeared about 2 weeks ago. They came out and they stated, quite frankly, a senior member of their government came out and stated frankly that they did not want the United States involved militarily in Afghanistan, that the United States was doing more harm than good, and it was time for them to leave. So clearly there are a lot of issues in terms of the economy, in terms of the American debt, which is largely owed to China, and in terms of the currency, the trading in terms of dollars on the international markets for oil. There are a lot of issues at stake here. And so, you know, as I said about Vietnam, Vietnam is minor in comparison to the ramifications of what happens in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, we have economic, we have security issues. Really, the whole idea of hunting al-Qaeda, as I stated, is really kind of a dream at this point. I mean, Mullah Omar is now, there was a front page article in the New York Times just a day ago about Mullah Omar, and he has suddenly miraculously appeared from nowhere. Osama bin Laden, of course, has never been found. I mean, what exactly has the United States been involved with the most expensive military budget in the history of civilization over the last 8 years doing, and they can't find two individuals who, especially in the case of Mullah Omar, when all the intelligence reports indicate that he has been residing in Quetta since 2001 and that he has been assisted by Pakistan's intelligence service. So, you know, there are a lot of issues here that are being forced to the surface, and Afghanistan, of course, is central to that mystery.
And there's also a fact, too, that the Pakistanis also have voiced the exact same position in terms of the American military presence in Afghanistan, that, in fact, the American military presence causes more problems for Pakistan. It may not resolve problems in Afghanistan, but it still causes problems for Pakistan because it causes the insurgency to move back into Pakistan, and that is something that Pakistan doesn't like. So it is clearly, you know, serving the in terms of the overall geopolitical interests of the region, it definitely serves Pakistan's interests the most to see a complete removal of any kind of Western involvement. And again, we're not trying to qualify, you know, the positive or negative effects of Western involvement. What we're talking about is if suddenly the West completely removed itself and suddenly Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and China were in charge, okay, what would happen? All right, and this is where you can see the vacuum is going to be very quickly filled by Pakistan's interest, which would be to have the Taliban run Afghanistan, which has always been to serve Pakistan's interests.
There have been a lot of analogies recently to the United States being in the same position that Britain was prior to World War II, after World War I, and there are a lot of similarities. The United States, of course, picked up the British Empire in 1947. And think of it this way, what would have happened had the United States not picked up the British Empire in 1947? It would have been the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s would have been a very, very different world. And so that's what we're looking at today. The United States is overextended militarily. Clearly, the United States is overextended financially. They're in debt to the Chinese. The Chinese are strategically positioned. The United States is trying to do something, and it's not really clear in Washington what exactly the United States is trying to do. I think that what we saw from the very beginning was that there's a number of different agendas going on here. There's a political agenda on the one hand, which, of course, back in the 1970s and 1980s was being pushed by the neoconservatives, and then you have the oil agenda. You have the international oil conglomerates who are trying to get pipelines, who are trying to get gas pipelines and oil pipelines, who are trying to secure Afghanistan for transit routes to various parts of the world. You have the Chinese, of course, now a major factor, trying to get transit routes back and forth from China to the port of Gwadar, which is part of the issue that we brought up in this article that we wrote. And so you have a very, very complex situation. The problem is that the signals that are coming out of Washington are very confused. Which signal is it? Are we pushing a geopolitical agenda? Are we trying to democratize the region? Are we invested in terms of the oil companies? Is the United States like it was in the 1990s? There's a lot of other books that were written back in, about in the late 90s and early 2000s about what was going on with the United States during the Clinton administration in terms of this energy pipeline. Steve Cole's book is an example. It's a good, is a very clear indication of what was going on there and how privatized American foreign policy had become during the Clinton era.
Correct. So, and it seems like we are still continuing some of our practices of 1980s, because the reason I brought up the East Turkestan is, the government in absentia set up by Yusuf Turani here in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And because of my previous job with the FBI and some of the operations that we dealt with, which involved Turkish counterintelligence, we got a lot of information that had to do with our operation, U.S. operations in East Turkestan, and mm-hmm. these are the covert operations, arming their mujahideens, their form of mujahideen there, via our proxy, the Turks, mm-hmm. because of the same heritage and the same language shared. And meanwhile, Yusuf Turani's monthly meeting with the State Department here, And again, these are all done, as you mentioned, because of the energy, the oil pipeline and the route, and also China. But again, doing and practicing exactly with the same methods that, that later we came out and we talked about as creating Taliban and creating the Al-Qaeda. And you see the same scenario, the same thing playing out in Central Asia, which is brewing. And again, we are doing it over there. In fact, between 1996 and 2002, we moved a lot of people from Xinjiang, from East Turkestan, and this is we being United States, with the help of Turkish both paramilitary and military forces, from Xinjiang into Central Asia, from Central Asia to Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
On the Russian front. So it seems like we are also, while we are doing this military operations, but we are still continuing those paramilitary and covert operations, again using and misusing Islam and also the minority groups there who have been seeking independence.
There's no question about that. And as I said, that there's a report by... Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies that you can get online. And it is basically a question as to why we are losing. There was a draft version that came out 2008, which was titled Why We're Losing in Afghanistan. And these stories really don't appear a lot in the American media, but yet they're being done by American think tanks. So you can see if Anthony Cordesman at CSIS is doing an investigation as to why the United States isn't targeting Mullah Omar for 7 or 8 years, leaving him alone and allowing the Taliban to reformulate their Al Qaeda connections and work their way across Central Asia, one wonders exactly what the agenda is coming from Washington.
Well, that actually was my original point when I said that, you know, when the Bush administration basically effectively was undermining the ability of Afghanistan to really reclaim its nation status, that really cannot be looked at just as a failure. You really have to consider the interests that are served by Afghanistan not being a nation state. And that is part of the original agenda that you have to go back into the 70s and look at. Pakistan has really always viewed Afghanistan as a pretty much, you know, a nation that was they'd rather not see as a strong state. And that by the early 90s, you know, with the creation of the Taliban and the idea of, you know, of installing a Pakistani-friendly government, well, that really wasn't the first time that that idea emerged. You really have to go back to the early 70s and the original insurgency that was being financed out of Pakistan with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Ahmad Massoud, and it was financed by the United States and the Saudis through Pakistan to destabilize the government of Mohammed Daoud, who took over in 1973 from the king. Who, you know, had a bloodless coup in 73, and it was referred to him after that coup, you know, as the Red Prince because he had been helped by the communists at that point. But the fact was, he was a nationalist. That really was what it was about, and that seemed to be in the sort of the death knell was the idea of any kind of strong Afghan state was against Pakistan's interests, and anything that supported that seemed to go through. But when you look at the idea of, you know, the Saudis, really beginning to view this region in terms of colonization, the interests that are represented by having Afghanistan as a transit, and there really are many natural resources there, too. It isn't just an issue of transit. There's also the ability to exploit the resources. But the idea of having a compliant state that really would offer no resistance and was run pretty much by the interests of Pakistan.
If you might.
I'm sorry, Paul, if I can just ask Liz to expand a little bit more there. I wanted to ask explicitly about the connections between the Afghan Taliban and the inter-services ISI, that's the equivalent of the CIA in Pakistan. And what were the origins of this? And at this point, what are the linkages? Is there any coordination between high-level Pakistani military and intelligence officials and today's Taliban, led by Mullah Omar?
Well, I think at this point, what you have to think of the term Taliban as kind of a catch-all that really, you know, you might as well be saying Catholic at this point. It really means a million things. In terms of the original idea of the Taliban, the word Talib basically just means seeker. It's a person, usually a male Muslim who is, and in Afghanistan, this was a part of the tradition. This is a part of the tradition for Muslim men to seek, a special kind of training. This was something that was turned into the Taliban, which was really a creation of the Pakistani intelligence that began in 1992 in order to guarantee that there would be a Pakistani-friendly government installed in Afghanistan after the Soviets withdrew in 89, after the civil war was going on, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was not really winning the war, and there was too much bloodshed going on. So this eventually was installed, was infused into the civil war. And when the Taliban was actually importing Afghan young men from the refugee camps, it gave it an Afghan component, but they were not the originators. They were not the ones running the show. And a lot of these young men were really coming out of poverty, out of starvation. So that was what was going on.
So what Liz is getting to is the fact that the Taliban in Pakistan are still working with the agenda of the Pakistani ISI. That is where they came from, that's what they were founded for, and that's what they're continuing to do. And the Pakistanis at this point are just simply, the Pakistani military and the Pakistani government is sitting back, not expecting the United States to continue on this enterprise because of the situation that is obvious to everyone else in the world, except apparently in Washington, that the United States cannot continue on this particular course. And so they're just simply continuing their connections. Yes, they are continuing their connections with the militants in Afghanistan and in Pakistan.
Now, recently, Mullah Omar apparently has been absolutely against, some of the activities of what has come out of the Pakistani Taliban, that there are delineations. The whole idea, as I mentioned earlier, about suicide bombing was absolutely alien to the Afghan idea of protest. This apparently does offend some of the Afghan Taliban, but you also have to realize that in Afghanistan today, if in fact the economy was actually functioning, the Afghanistan Taliban wouldn't exist, apparently. That is basically more a result of a failed economy. You have over a 40% unemployment rate. You have a crisis where people basically have to take jobs where they can. The Taliban is basically able to, between drug running and other illicit operations, they are the only ones that have any kind of stable economy. So, if you want to work for the government, you make less money than if you work for the Taliban. So some of a good percentage of the problem with the Taliban in Afghanistan really is related to the economy. And so these are part of the complexity of the crisis that is really not understood. But when you do see what's coming out of Pakistan, remember that it was President Zia-ul-Huq who turned the Pakistani military into an Islamist focused kind of military, that there was much more of a secular military in Pakistan preceding that President Zia's run. And he was the one who was choosing all of the Mujahideen in the 1980s, who was going to get the money. They were the most extremist. They were definitely not typical of who was in Afghanistan at the time.
Mm-hmm. Paul, a little while back there, I cut in on you. I apologize. Do you recall your point? You want to make it now?
Yeah, I just wanted to, if I can, I just wanted to bring up this Anthony Cordesman report from CSIS, the New Metrics of Afghanistan is what it's called. And, he starts this report out. Now, my point about this is that if this is coming out of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, then, what exactly is going on here? This is a quote from the report. No one who works with the unclassified data on Afghanistan can fail to be aware of how poor and contradictory much of that data now are. In general, no NATO ISDAF government, including the United States, has yet provided an honest or meaningful picture of the war. Far too often, official reporting has been tailored to report success when the Taliban, Hekmatyar, and Haqqani were actually scoring major gains. In other cases, key problems in the Afghan government, the NATO ISAF effort, and the economic aid effort were ignored or disguised as successes. It goes on. I mean, it's absolutely an indictment of the way in which just the basic way in which the United States has been conducting this campaign for the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the role of China here and China's call for the U.S. to end its military actions in Afghanistan. I wanted to get a quick comment on Russia, because I don't know if you reacted the same way, but President Obama made his first trip to Moscow, and the headlines were about his call to eliminate nuclear weapons, and that's a wonderful goal and certainly newsworthy. But I thought more urgent and more immediate was the agreement from Medvedev and Putin to allow U.S. to overfly Russian and its republic's airspace in order to resupply Afghanistan. And that struck me as highly ironic, that here is Russia facilitating our route to their boneyard.
Well, you know, it's become our boneyard, too. I think that that is something that I don't think... This is almost a philosophical issue. The United States got into Vietnam, did not win in Vietnam, and then instead of taking the Vietnam loss in Washington and reassessing the way in which the United States expressed itself overseas in terms of its Cold War posture, with detente as an example, that was a big factor that was happening during that time period, as you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of pursuing detente, Zbigniew Brzezinski once again stepped in and tipped the scales against the Soviet Union, against Russia, and to China. So what's happening now is that he played what was called the China card at that time. He used China exclusively against the Soviet Union in order to establish pretty much a military relationship and, of course, economic relationship with the Chinese. That was not necessarily what Cyrus Vance at the State Department or President Carter had in mind. But when Zbigniew Brzezinski took the horns of this dilemma and steered it in that direction, what we're living with today is the end result of that. So in a sense, this is almost, the fact that we're there today and relying on the Soviets, our arch enemy of the Cold War, but certainly prior to detente. So we're right back to where we were 30 years ago, 31 years ago. And once again, it's very interesting to look at the situation today and see how the China card, Brzezinski, of course, is still trying to play the China card. He's trying to set up what's called, he's referring to it as the G2, the group of two, China and the United States. China is the big manufacturer and the Americans is the big consumers. Well, it would appear that, you know, there are other agendas at work here. And one of those agendas is to try to equalize the relationship with the Russians, and that's what's going on. That's a faction of what's going on in Washington today.
And there's also another side to this equation that we really have to bring up, and that is the fact that if Brzezinski had not actually activated his Black Project that he has actually gone on record as activating in 1998 by having President Carter sign the authority for the intentional provocation of the Soviet Union on the southern border and for propaganda campaigns to go on to spook the Soviets into invading Afghanistan, we really have to question whether the Soviets actually might have crossed that border in the first place. Brzezinski likes to claim that the reason he did this is because there was no question that Soviets were going to do this, and all I was doing was just enhancing the chances. But what we did in our research is really look at the evidence, and it really isn't there. There is no evidence to support Brzezinski's position that the Soviets, in fact, would have invaded if they had not been spooked and not been intentionally provoked to do it. So these are the kinds of issues I think we need to realize. So today when we see the Soviets, now the Russians, obviously, in the form of the Russians, actually presenting any kind of opportunity for the Americans, I think we really have to begin to wonder about America's viewpoint over the last, since World War II, from the very start of the Cold War, from the very idea of our relationship with the Soviet Union that's now turned into that relationship with Russia, whether it always had to be that way. What kind of relationship was it really about, and what is it today? And who's really the source of the problem that's going on here?
I want to talk a little bit about what Professor Alfred McCoy refers to as the politics of heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read a little passage here from his book, While in 1979, Pakistan had a small and local opium trade and produced no heroin, by 1981, according to U.S. Attorney General William French Smith, Pakistan emerged as the world's leading supplier of heroin, became the supplier of nearly 60% of U.S. heroin supply, and took over major sections of the markets in Europe. Now, who were these manufacturers? They were all either military factions connected with Pakistan intelligence, CIA allies, or Afghan resistance groups connected with the CIA and Pakistan intelligence. Now, fast forward, because this was based on 1980s and 1990s, to today, when the estimated value of heroin coming from Afghanistan is around $40 to $50 billion, and again, based on the reports we are getting, and this is either by the Europol or the United Nations or even the State Department, about only 10% of it goes to the Afghan warlords and the Afghanis, but about 90% of it is managed and it goes to the foreign governments, but nobody is naming these foreign governments, plural.
The situation with the drugs is another one of those big question marks that comes up when it comes to Afghanistan. Why did Afghanistan suddenly become the world's leading supplier of heroin to the world? And we're not just talking, you know, opium at this raw opium. We're talking about refined heroin that's being exported. There is a whole system that's been worked out. And there have been a number of accusations about collaborators, if you want to call it that, in governments
right.
in Europe that are still working on an agenda that sees enormous amounts of heroin shipped to Russia, as an example, in order to weaken the Russian state, in order to continue playing this kind of great game.
Actually, the Russians are suffering from phenomenal drug addiction problems right now, and one of the reasons they probably are engaging as much as they are with the United States in terms of trying to calm the Afghan situation down was directly revolving around drugs.
And just remember, I mean, we still tend to think of this issue as an American problem. We're sending an American army to go fight in this, and we're trying to get the Europeans, we're trying to get NATO to go along with us. But you have to realize, I mean, in terms of the agenda, I mentioned the oil agenda. I mean, this is an entire, they have their own, the oil agenda has its own lobbyists, they have their own different countries that are involved, the security establishments of those countries, and the drug industry, the illegal drug industry, of course, they have billions of dollars worth of investment in this thing, and they've got lots of people who are capable of moving those drugs over various borders. You can't do that without controlling certain levers of power in these various governments, and of course that has an effect. And what is interesting at this point is that's why Afghanistan was such a catalyst for this process, because so much of that was privatized during that time period. All the rules that had been put into place in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s by the Nixon administration, and the Shah of Iran as an example, and the Afghan government, and these various governments, the government of Pakistan, to try to limit opium growth and drug export from that part of the world. All of those things were just simply thrown out the window when the United States left Vietnam in 1975 and the Cold War moved. The drug war moved from Southeast Asia to South Central Asia, as did the Cold War. And so that's what we're living with today. And there's no question about it. I mean, you know, with that kind of money involved in the situation, you have to have certain government people involved. They're certainly not, I mean, anyone who was a legitimate representative of that government would be insane in order to get involved in this kind of drug trade. But as the Time magazine correspondent put it to us when we were in Kabul, he told us, he'd been out there, he said, you know, during the war in the 1980s, the planes came in full of weapons and they left full of narcotics. And the fact is that, you know, when you're in a place like Afghanistan or Pakistan, that kind of money gives individual actors a lot of power, and that's what's going on right now. Individual actors in today's world, with the kind of technology, with satellite phones and the kinds of things that are available, those people have a lot of power.
But a lot of the power did come from the drugs being allowed to grow wildly during the 1980s in order to finance effectively off-the-books projects, off-the-book activities, and that is the method. That's always been the method used. In terms of, you know, the CIA, that is the method. But in terms of the Afghan war, it really, you know,
it took on a life
of its own. Exactly.
Yeah.
And what is the status today? Is the U.S. military or our intelligence apparatus involved in the Afghan drug trade in any way?
There has been no specific evidence of that happening. That has not been an area of our interest. Our interest has been political. It has not been in terms of the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
So we do not have any evidence or even hearsay, but there are all kinds of issues. And the fact is that the American military doesn't have to be involved in the drug trade at this point in order for the agenda to be carried forward.
Well, truthfully, all the American military has to do is simply not do anything. That's the point. It isn't, you know, you just have to let it happen. In fact, one has to wonder how you can have 40 countries involved in Afghanistan and all this drug trade going on. I mean, how come nobody is able to seem to deal with it? So it does seem to have a life of its own at this point.
We're talking with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould here on The Boiling Frogs. You can visit their website, InvisibleHistory.com, and that's tagged off their recent book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. And I took a look at your website, and there's some interesting links to Professor Chalmers Johnson. He's written a trilogy of books, the Blowback series, and he's a retired professor of history, I believe from UC San Diego. And I've had the opportunity to talk to him a couple of times. And he focuses on this concept of blowback. And I'd like to ask you each to give us a couple of examples of blowback against the United States that is a result of our intervention supporting the Mujahideen in their opposition to the Soviet occupiers in the 1980s.
Well, I think the biggest blowback is what happened in 2001 and the loss of freedoms and constitutional rights that we've been guaranteed. I mean, I hate to say that it was set up to work that way, but the fact is that, you know, this is a cause and effect relationship. You know, foreign policy in the United States is kind of a private game preserve. Certain people are involved are. There are families that have been involved with it from generation to generation to generation. There are certain schools involved with it. There were books written back in the 1960s and 1970s that talked about the fact that you could look at all the people in the State Department and the foreign policy establishment in the United States, and they all went to at least the same six of the same universities and all lived in New York City within about six blocks of each other. I mean, and they all worked at either the same brokerage firms or the same law firms.
We even heard a rumor that you actually get checked like seven generations back in order to prove you're worthy of working at certain levels in the State Department. You know, so there's extreme ideas about, you know, who gets into that.
You know, and I'll tell you a funny story. I mean, we did a lot of political work back in the 70s, and one of the individuals that we worked for was involved in the nuclear freeze campaign, and they said to us at one point, they were giving a lecture to their audience, and they said, well, you know, there's no secret door, there's no place we can go, you know, I'm a member of the United States government, and I don't have a key to the bunker in case we get into war. You know, we're all going to go, we all have the same interest you have. And then the individual got selected to be a higher level and a committee member, and somebody knocked on his door one day, and it was said, you know, this is the FBI, and here's your key to the bunker in case there's a nuclear war. You know, it was a surprise to them. The fact is that, you know, we do have a hierarchical society, and, you know, people refer to this as a conspiracy. Well, there's a conspiracy to do this, there's a conspiracy to do that. Well, it's not a conspiracy. I mean, this is just simply the way the system functions. They don't tell you everything you know on the shop floor that's going on in the front office. And that's exactly what's happening right now. And I just happen to think that in terms of blowback, I think we're just beginning to feel the blowback from Afghanistan and the United States. And, you know, and it's a tragic irony that we should be committing troops there at this point for an unseen future, for an uncertain solution to what's happening there. But in a way, it's almost, I think you have to look at this philosophically. I think, the United States, Zbigniew Brzezinski, engineered this collapse of the Soviet Union by using Afghanistan as the trigger. And now the United States has found itself in exactly the same position with a very weakened economy. I mean, the Soviet Union did not die as a result of Afghanistan. It was a very weakened beast to begin with. When we interviewed Paul Warnke again in 1993, we went back down and interviewed him, And he said that, you know, that he had been to the Soviet Union with Robert McNamara in the late 1960s in the Lyndon Johnson administration. And he said that, you know, they were approached by a lot of mid-level bureaucrats in the Soviet Union at that time, people like Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And he said that they came to them and they admitted, they said, we know the Soviet Union is not going to last. And they said, but we don't know how to get out from under our hawks. You have your hawks in the United States. We have our hawks in Russia. We don't know how to get out from under them. And that was the beginnings of detente. And that was what, of course, was ended with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So it is a fitting it's a fitting conclusion to a Cold War relationship that really began on December 7th, 1941, and something that we really have in terms of a national debate. We really have to sit back and look at the world from a very different perspective now that our superpower status is really being called into question at this point, and it's within the next 6 months or to a year, regardless of what happens in Afghanistan, it's going to be a very different world.
And Liz, do you have a comment on blowback?
Well, I think that what we're looking at really is an endless cycle of cause and effect, and you know, when you really go into the whole idea of resolving anything with any kind of of aggression, you're going to have to look at the effect. So, you know, here we are looking at, a process. I think that, certainly the ultimate, I mean, I know the term blowback sometimes has been used, where whether it was 9/11 actually blowback. You know, there's a lot of even questions as to whether it wasn't more specific. There are people who definitely believe that it was actually plotted. So even that becomes a more extreme, you might think, version of blowback. People have such distrust for those in power within the United States government that they believe that they would actually plot that themselves. So that's even more extreme. But the idea that we have actually activated things that are affecting us now, I absolutely think is happening. I think when Brzezinski specifically played the China card, that to me is actually a piece of blowback that we're now just beginning to identify. That there has been a very long-term sort of underground relationship that the United States has had with China to balance its relationship, especially during the Cold War to the Soviet Union, that now is beginning to play out. And I think that these are things that really have not even been talked about. We feel that the actual merger between extreme Islam and Maoism is really something that hasn't even been dealt with yet. And that is a merger that we have to view as probably as potent a merger as the original Christians merging with, the power of the Roman Empire. These are forces of thoughts and ideas that were put together at a time when nobody thought about it. So, I mean, in terms of potential blowback, I don't even think we've really come to realize where this really can go. And I think that's part of what we're trying, I mean, we, meaning Paul and I, are trying to look into the future and see where some of these ideas are headed. And we're definitely very, very aware of the fact that that is something that nobody is talking about.
And that was a movement, by the way, that was very much the beginnings of it were in vogue back in the 1970s, early 1980s. And by Maoism, we mean the political organizing capacity of Maoism and the radical extremism, religious fervor of Islam, combined together into a kind of hybrid form of political movement that has the potential in that part of the world. So there's all kinds of issues, involved in this particular Afghanistan issue. This is the center of it. And Nepal, Afghanistan, Tibet, and Pakistan, these are all in Iran as well. These are all centers of this kind of thinking and these kind of political movements, and it's definitely not something that the West has faced before, but certainly what the United States did in terms of blowback provided the incubation period and the incubator. It provided the resources and the means for that to come about, and that's what we're about to experience.
Now, returning to the present situation, there was an attempt at elections in August, and widespread fraud has been reported. There was jockeying in the United Nations observer contingent, and the American Peter Galbraith was sent home. And more recently, the head of that UN effort has acknowledged that there was massive fraud committed in this election. And I'd ask you to comment on that, and also just the broader question of how mistaken are we to try to force democracy on the nation of Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, this is part of what we address, a large part of what we address in the book. The fact is that there has been a progressive strain in Afghan politics since at least the 1880s. In fact, it even goes back a lot further than that. It goes back to the 16th century with Bayezid Ansari, who was a Pashtun who led a revolt against the Mughal Empire. So, you know, and of course in the 1880s, the beginnings of the modern Afghan state were very much, I mean, he may have been Abdul Rahman may have been a tyrant in many ways. He's considered that by many Afghans. At the same time, he's considered a tyrant because he solidified the central government. He established a lot of rules and laws and returned something to the people of Afghanistan. And certainly in terms of a nationhood, he gave the Afghan people, all the ethnicities of Afghanistan, the sense that they were a part of a nation. And that progressed until the 1920s when Amanullah came along.
And you have, of course, Amanullah giving women and all the ethnicities rights. Women were given the right to vote. So you can see that the idea of being very impressed with Western ideals, with Western concepts of modernization, the Afghans totally embraced it. In fact, one of the great surprises that we came upon was a quote from 1832, East India Company political officer Alexander Burns, writing home to his mother about meeting Afghans. He says, "The people of this country are kind-hearted and hospitable. They have no prejudice against a Christian and none against our nation." Now, this is in 1832. By 1839, the British were invading Afghanistan. Instead of listening to Alexander Burns' advice, which was to work with the strength of these people, they are good people, they would make good friends, they would make a good ally, but instead the British decided they'd rather colonize them. And of course that began a process that we're still living with today.
As we close, I wanted to ask some advice from each of you. I recently saw an interview with Secretary of State Clinton where she said that we're listening to advice from all sources. And there is a very clear debate underway in the administration, and Vice President Biden appears to be pushing hard for a scaled-back mission definition in Afghanistan. So I'd like you each to offer your unvarnished advice to this administration on what you think the appropriate next steps are.
Well, I can say one thing about Secretary of State Clinton's position that I definitely think really exposes, I think, a limit to her concepts about what can be done. On the one hand, you know, after the latest bombing in Pakistan, you know, she takes the position that there should be no concern about the Pakistani government's ability to manage their nuclear warheads and maintain stability in a very, very delicate and very crisis-ridden situation. But yet, in the exact same breath, she is then expressing concern about Iran's future, development of bombs. So I'm saying now, how is it possible that, you know, you can look at an already very, very, very delicate situation, crisis-ridden situation, and still view this other situation that is a future event? This is not what we're focused on now, because this has not happened yet. So I wonder sometimes about how Secretary Clinton is delineating between what really is important today, what do we have to deal with today, and that is a great concern, because we feel right now that Pakistan has shown a tremendous influence in the region that has really not served Afghanistan's interests at all.
The United States is still trying to balance between supporting Pakistan as an ally and establishing itself as an assistant to the democracy-building process in Afghanistan. It unfortunately can't do both. It has to do one or the other. The problem is that the Pakistani state has been very duplicitous in terms of the way in which they have conducted their business, both in Afghanistan and with the United States. And one of the things that is involved with this issue is the United States has gotten involved with helping Pakistan maintain its state structure. Unfortunately, the state structure of Pakistan is quite faulty. A lot of what's driving the war right now are issues of Baloch and Pashtun independence. There are large independence movements that have been ongoing for many, many years. In fact, the Pashtun independence movement has been part of the original problem with the British Empire. The British marched up to the Hindu Kush and invaded Afghanistan on three separate occasions, and in 1893 drew a line down the middle of the Hindu Kush and said, you manage what's on your side of the line and we'll manage what's ours. Our side will be British India. Well, that was never resolved. The Afghans never accepted that. They drew a line right down the middle of Pashtun tribal homeland. That's never been resolved, and that has been an issue from day one with the relationship with the United States and with the United and the relationship between Afghanistan and the United States. It was an issue during the Cold War. Whenever the Pashtuns in Afghanistan, whenever the royal family would raise the issue of to return the territory, which would constitute about 5/8 of what today is Pakistan, the Pakistanis would get on the telephone and pick up the phone and get to Washington and say those Afghans are at it again. And so this has been an ongoing struggle. And the United States, I think, is really torn between those two issues. So I think if Washington really wants to get to the heart of the matter, they're going to have to take up the issue of Baloch and Pashtun independence. There's going to have to be another plebiscite like there was in 1947, and except this time it's going to have to be overseen by the United Nations, and the collective world security is going to be involved in it. And I think that would probably be a magic bullet, if you want to call it that, in this situation that would change the situation overnight.
Paul Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Gould, the co-authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Again, their website, invisiblehistory.com. Thank you both very much for joining us on The Boiling Frogs.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.